Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So here's the question. Why is there so much poverty in America today? In your neighborhood, my neighborhood, in the communities in which we live, why do we drive by it, you know, roll up the window, or think that we're doing something when we give out a little bit of pocket change or buy someone a Happy Meal? My guest today, Matthew Desmond, wrote a book because he needed an answer to those questions. And despite being the most prosperous democracy in the world, we have, by almost every measure, the worst poverty in the world. More than 38 million of our fellow Americans cannot afford their basic necessities: home, food, clothing. So why does this land of plenty allow one in eight of its children to go without those basic necessities, permitting scores of its citizens to live and, quite frankly, die on the streets? And at the same time, I guess, authorize its corporations to pay poverty wages? Matthew Desmond is a social scientist, an urban ethnographer, and professor of sociology, as well as the director of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. His research and reporting on American poverty and public policy earned him the MacArthur Fellowship, and his 2016 book, Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City, won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. He is here today. We're going to talk about that and his new work, Poverty by America, which is out now. And we're going to get into those questions and a whole lot more coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome to our conversation. I'm really excited to have Matt here with us to talk about the work that he's been doing in an area that, given all the politics and everything else going on, we kind of, I think, lose sight of from time to time, is how people are trying to make their lives and their ends meet, how, as a nation, we're dealing with one of the most pervasive problems that we have in poverty. And Matthew, you've done a lot of work in this area, and I'm really, really glad to welcome you to the conversation, man.
Oh, it's great to be here, Michael. Thanks so much for having me.
So in your book, you write, "We accept the current state of affairs. All right, we like it." And I say that a lot about where we are in politics. As much as everybody wrings their hands and complains and moans about it, they like the drama. They like the exhilaration from it. But when it comes to poverty, that's a whole different kind of conversation. What is it that we accept about this current state of affairs with respect to the poor in this country? What is it we like, and who is we?
Yeah, right. I think we have to face the cold, hard fact that a lot of us profit from poverty. You know, we consume the cheap goods and services that the working poor produce. Many of us are invested in the stock market. And when our savings go up, often that goes up because some wages are kept low. And those profits come at a human sacrifice.
Right.
You know, many of us protect tax breaks that are accrued to the top 20% of Americans. And if we didn't have so much poverty and eviction and homelessness, maybe we can live with that state of affairs. But currently, we do a lot more to guard fortunes than to fight poverty. And then many of us continue to be segregationist. We draw walls around our communities and hoard opportunity behind those walls. And who is the we? You know, I think that we always want the we to be the guy right above us on the cloud. Right. That guy I might be comfortable, but that guy's really comfortable. And so I think the we is a lot of us, those who have found some economic security and privilege in this country.
Yeah, it really begs a lot of different questions that some answers are harder to answer than some others. But the fact that we don't even seemingly have the conversation, Matt, is where I kind of begin in this. I spent a lot of my formative years and certainly at one point was on a direction of becoming a priest and living my life of poverty, chastity, and obedience, such as it were, and working with and living in communities of the poor to try to improve life. While I chose a different course, I still carry out that work as do a lot of people through Catholic Charities and other organizations that I'm affiliated with, trying to figure out how we fix the problem. Certainly was an issue when I was lieutenant governor, looking at more directly the causal relationship between your paycheck and your lack of opportunity, and why this school district looks worse off than the one right next to it. And you touch on a lot of these different factors and areas that sort of drive the engine of poverty. What are some of those that you see that are most pernicious in not helping us move the needle on this subject?
A big one is exploitation. And a lot of us don't like that word, but it just kind of comes down to choice. You know, when our choice is really constricted, we often find ourselves in a bad position and taken advantage of for that. You know, there used to be a time when the job market delivered for a lot of Americans, you know, folks that had a college degree and folks that didn't. But as workers have lost power over the years, companies have gained it. And for a lot of folks, wages have stagnated. You know, for folks without a high school diploma, workers, they got paid less in 2017, 10% less than they would have in 1979, adjusting for inflation. That's a bad situation. And there's exploitation going on in the housing market and the financial markets as well that we really need to confront.
Well, so the housing market is an interesting creature simply because of, and again, you talk about race and the role that it plays, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But, you know, the redlining of areas and then suddenly the decision, oh, we're going to invest in this area, then pushing the poor out. Into some other part because developers and others have decided that now is the time to make an investment in this community, but we're not going to make that investment as long as the poor are here. What is that mindset? What does that tell you? Where does it come from? Because I would think that if I've got a community that is on hard rocks at the moment, and they need a Starbucks and a local mart, or, you know, hey, let's invest in the dry cleaner and in the grocery store that's already there to sort of encourage and incentivize the community to take whatever little bit they do have and keep it in that community, number one. But then that feeds the job engine, and that feeds the home valuation engine, et cetera. What is the problem with that strategy, that it doesn't seem to be something that the government, developers, and even some communities are willing to invest in?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like we're giving a stage 4 cancer patient a couple Tylenol and we're wondering why nothing's working. A lot of times, you know, we know what works. We can make these deeper investments and we can afford to make them deeper without increasing the deficit. But a lot of times we just hold back programs that are necessary. So if you focus on the housing market, right, you talked about the legacy of racism in there, and that's a huge part of the story, right? Most Black Americans now are renters. Most Hispanic American families are renters, but most white families are homeowners. And so, and they get entitlements that renters don't, right? They get things like the mortgage interest deduction. Whereas if you're a poor renting family, you basically have one choice about where to live. You can't live in public housing or get any kind of assistance because the waiting list for those programs often stretch into the years, even the decades, you know, decades long waiting list for public housing. And then you're shut out of homeownership, not because you can't afford a mortgage, but because banks aren't interested in doing business with you. And so you're stuck. And so when you're stuck, you're exploited and exploitable. And so most poor renting families now spend over half of their income on housing costs. This is a broken system. And it's hard for those of us that are homeowners to really wrap our heads around how damaging and brutal the rental market is. Because for us, housing really works, right? Our rents don't go up. We pay the same amount. For many of us, our home is a wealth builder. But for a third of the country, the housing market just is failing them in really significant ways.
So how do these systems that we have in place, and this is, I think, one of the, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the central themes or pushes in your latest book, Poverty by America, is this idea that you have these government programs, right? That I guess on paper they're supposed to work, but in reality, they actually exacerbate or make the problem worse. I mean, you talk about the for example, the ways in which government resources have been misused or underutilized. You talk about the Clinton era welfare program called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. In 2020, poor families received just 22 cents in every dollar it dispersed. The rest was used by states to pay for such things as job training, even abstinence, only sex education.
Right.
Okay, so how does putting the bulk of those resources into abstinence programs, sexual behavior programs versus food deserts and programs where, you know, people are trying to make rent or whatever? I mean, what is the disconnect between the government programming and the people they're supposed to help?
It's a huge disconnect. And I want to be clear, there's so many government programs that are lifesavers to low-income families.
Sure.
Right? There are government programs that are really saving millions of folks from homelessness and hunger every year. But you're right. There are these massive inefficiencies also built into our system. And so states now have a lot of leeway about how to spend those welfare dollars. And there's only one state, Kentucky, that spends most of the welfare dollars and dollars in hand to low-income families. And look, this is kind of a policy conversation, but what we're talking about, right, is the poorest kids in America not getting enough because states aren't deeply investing in their families. It's not just a red state or a blue state issue.
Right.
You know, Tennessee is sitting on $700 million in unspent welfare funds, but Hawaii is sitting on enough that they could give every poor kid in their state $10,000. So this is really a nationwide problem. And it suggests that a low-hanging fruit here is just make sure that the programs that we already have on the books are working to maximum capacity.
So we've just come on the other side of a global pandemic. And we know, in addition to the horror stories that resulted in the loss of life, there are also very difficult stories regarding how people are surviving or trying to survive post-COVID. How did the pandemic, in the first instance, highlight and put a real spotlight on the eviction issues and the poverty issues that we're now having to confront?
I think there were several lessons out of the pandemic. One is, you know, America was unique among advanced democracies to have an eviction crisis immediately when COVID hit, right? It's not like France and Germany suddenly had an eviction crisis. That was us. And that should signal how fragile life is for so many tenants below the poverty line. And so the government stepped up, right? It passed an eviction moratorium that lasted almost a year. That moratorium was passed under the Trump administration and then lasted into the Biden administration. Studies have shown that decreased deaths by 11%, saved tens of thousands of lives.
Right.
And then the government rolled out emergency rental assistance, which was just basically a big chunk of money, $46.5 billion directed at tenants who had fallen behind in COVID and dropped the eviction rate to the lowest ever on record. And it stayed that way for months and months and months after the moratorium left. What's the lesson here? One of the lessons is, man, government programs, when they flex, when they're bold, can make a giant difference in the lives of the most vulnerable families in America. Look at the child tax credit, right? Which is just basically a check that was mailed out to middle and low income families.
Right.
Cut child poverty by 46% in 6 months.
But that program is being phased out now. So when you hear that, going back to, again, how government looks like it tends to get in its own way in solving some of these issues, what does that say? What does next year and the next 3-5 years look like since we saw it work?
Yeah.
And the government seemingly was okay with writing that check.
Yeah.
And pulling 40 million kids off the poverty rolls. What does that look like now?
Congress should have been terrified to take those benefits away from us. You know, they should have been incredibly scared of the voter response, but the movement wasn't there. We weren't loud enough. You know, we should have been demanding that this become the new normal. And what happened was predictably, right? You had the same old kind of concerns about cost of the program,
right?
And how much this would cost. And look, costs are important, but let's just focus on a single study that came out a few years ago that showed that if the top 1% just paid the taxes they owed, not paid more taxes, just stopped evading taxes,
right?
We could raise an additional $175 billion a year. That's more than enough to reinstate the child tax credit. You know, that's enough to double our investment in affordable housing. That's almost enough to pull everyone below the poverty line out of poverty. So I think that we have to resist that scarcity mindset and realize that the country can do big things without, you know, driving up the deficit. Yeah.
So, Matt, why didn't we say anything? Why didn't the country, I mean, the actual people who saw and received the benefit, say something? There's been no hue and cry from the masses, whether they are in poverty or not, whether they are wealthy or not. I mean, people have just basically been fixated on the latest, you know, drama, either on TV, sports, or, you know, the reality TV we call politics. And yet these seemingly life affirming or life threatening moments, they just don't seem to have anything to say. It's like the gun issue. You know, we have another mass shooting and six people die and everybody does thoughts and prayers and just kind of sits back and waits for the next newscast telling us, hey, guess it's happened again. So what is it that you found in your research and in the work that you've done in this space, going all the way back to your book in 2016, Evicted? Where you talked about that, you know, the poverty and profit motives that are driven a lot of, you know, American cities. What is it about the American people that we don't seem to get exercised about the fact that 40 million kids are now going to be put back into poverty?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough question. I think that, you know, there were these beautiful TikTok videos and expressions of relief for families that benefited from these programs during COVID. You know, it was really wonderful to watch families just express gratitude and breathe a little bit. But you're right. You know, I think that we have as a country been so, I mean, we're sliding back to normal. We're sliding back to a place where evictions are commonplace. We're sliding back to a place where 1 in 9 of us, you know, can't afford basic necessities. And I think that those of us who are searching and longing for a better world are often very fluent in the language of critique, but kind of bumbling in the language of repair. You know, we know how to point a finger and say, not that. That's
right.
Bad.
Right.
We need to develop a better language of saying, Man, I want to live in a world where there's half as many evictions as there were last year. I want to live in that world. I want to live in a world where, you know, we keep cutting child poverty. Let's try to get that thing to zero. So I think we need to really develop that capacity and that you know, that imagination, that word of promise.
Right, we're going to take a quick break because when we come back, I want to pick up on that point to talk about what that language sounds like. Yeah. What are the words we should be thinking about using and sort of connect your earlier work, Evicted, with your latest work, Poverty, and see whether we can figure out what that language is. We're having a great conversation with Matthew Desmond. He is a social scientist and director of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. A whole lot more with Matt right after this.
Hey, folks, this is Charlie Sykes, host of the Bulwark podcast and friend of the Michael Steele Show. We created the Bulwark to provide a platform for pro-democracy voices on the center right and the center left, for people who are tired of tribalism and who value truth and vigorous yet civil debate about politics and a lot more. And every day we remind you folks, you are not the crazy ones. On my daily podcast, and that's right, we do it five times a week, I'm joined by some of the smartest, savviest, most provocative voices on the scene. And every day, we have great conversations. You won't always agree, but you won't be disappointed. So why not head over to thebulwark.com and take a look around? Every day, we produce newsletters and podcasts that will help you make sense of our politics and keep your sanity intact. To get a daily dose of sanity in your inbox, why not try a Bulwark Plus membership free for the next 30 days? To claim this offer, go to thebulwark.com/Charlie. That's thebulwark.com/Charlie. We're going to get through this together. I promise.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. We're trying to do a deep dive into the issues and questions around poverty in America and why, especially in this post-COVID period where we've seen the emasculation and elimination of a program that moved 40 million children out of poverty, where seemingly people just kind of going along, you know, as we were before without much noise around this issue. Well, there is someone who's making a noise and writing about strategies in which we as citizens can begin to change and reform the system, and that is Matthew Desmond, who's joined us. Matthew, I want to pick up on your last point before the break about the language that we should be looking to employ to change this conversation so that we can better engage in solving the problem, maybe even put it out there, get better at electing people who actually give a damn about the problem. I think that kind of feeds into the beast too. I know on my side, the first thing anybody starts screaming and crying about, you know, when you talk about various solutions, is, oh, it costs too much. Mm-hmm. And when I hear that from representatives in places like Mississippi, the poorest state in the country, Appalachia, West Virginia, Alabama, in other places, especially in the South, which is riven with poverty, even though seemingly they act like it doesn't exist there. At some point, we've got to begin to move this needle. What should we be saying? How should we be talking about this? And what are some of the strategies you think we can start to employ like 10 minutes from now?
Yeah. I think we need to commit ourselves to becoming poverty abolitionists. And we can do that 10 minutes from now, you know,
right.
And we can say, look, poverty isn't just a minor social issue. It's not something we have to live with. It's an abomination. The richest country in the world shouldn't have to put up with it. And I think we see and share with other abolitionist movements the conviction that profiting from someone else's pain drags us all down, diminishes us all. And so poverty abolitionism is a different way of talking about poverty. You know, it's a different way of shopping. It's a different way of investing. It's a different way of thinking about our taxes and our benefits and in our neighborhoods. So a poverty abolitionist during tax season might, instead of complaining about the big old tax bill you got to write, you know,
right,
in April, say, you know, I'm getting these tax breaks for my mortgage, for my kids' college savings. And man, it makes me uncomfortable that the country is spending so much more on those than they are to fight poverty. I'm gonna write my congressperson about this. You know, that's a step. You know, when we're talking about neighborhoods and opening up these neighborhoods for promise, that's not just talk. That means going down to your zoning board meeting, you know, Tuesday night, and standing up and saying, look, I refuse to borrow their kids from the opportunity my kids have living in this place. Let's build this thing. And so I think that poverty abolitionism is kind of, you know, this moral ambition. And we used to have that moral ambition as a country, right? When we launched the war on poverty in 64, Johnson wasn't playing. They set a deadline, you know, and I'd love us to kind of reach back to that sense of moral urgency and ambition. That to me is very American.
So that's a very interesting point you just made about the Johnson administration in 64, the war on poverty. Tag that for us a little bit, sort of give us sort of the historical outcome from those efforts and relate it to what's happened since then. Because I think we can make the case that it's all been downhill since then. And not in a good way.
No, yeah. So, I mean, one place to start is by recognizing that in the 60s, Congress was a mess. You know, the Dixiecrats were aligning.
Being more of a mess than it is today.
It was a mess. You know, senators were sleeping in their offices, filibustering reform, right? It was incredibly divided. The country was anti-democratic, in fact, you know, by barring African Americans from the voting booth.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, in that cauldron, major passes of civil rights legislation was passed, and the War on Poverty and Great Society were passed. And why? And I think there's pretty convincing historical evidence that the labor movement and the civil rights movement just forced Congress's hand. And I think that should give us hope. And I think that, you know, we've been here before, and our hope lies in the movements. The War on Poverty and the Great Society did things like make food aid permanent, expand Medicaid, expand Social Security. Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, but, you know, several generations ago, so many elderly Americans were just dying penniless. And just these massive investments in the poorest families. And if you compare the poverty line in 1970 to 1960, it was basically cut in half. You know, the War on Poverty and Great Society really drove down the poverty line, and particularly for African-American families and particularly for kids, too.
So I'm not one who generally likes to do the European comparison thing, you know, because our system is fundamentally different than the European models, particularly when it comes to the economic piece. But I presume, not presume, but I'm aware of and know that there are some examples and some measures in this area that we could learn from. How are other countries addressing poverty in their communities? And what can we potentially learn from them? Not that there's a one-for-one correlation by any stretch, or by just cool your jets on that. Mm-hmm. But the reality of it is there, you know, we're never too big or too smart to learn, right? And there are some good examples. Could you share a few of them?
Sure. You know, simply put, a lot of other countries invest a higher percentage of their GDP in social programs, you know? So if you look at Germany, for example, there's just a deeper investment in social housing than there is here. And that's something that journalists live in, teachers live in, firefighters live in, the poorest folks in Germany live in. It's not stigmatized, and it's integrated, and it works. There are programs in Canada that establish just the right to housing, for example. I think that just in the nitty gritty of things, you know, it's the bigger picture is kind of like they collect a bit more taxes and they invest that in their people. And that is a bargain that I could totally live with. And so to me, the hard part isn't knowing what to do or how to pay for it. The hard part is building a political will. And this is what the movements are doing now. And this is what I hope my book is contributing to.
Your book back in 16 that touched on, that really kind of began to open up the door on this conversation, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, won the Pulitzer Prize for General nonfiction and changed the conversation a bit. I think people would say, tell us how that, what the thrust of Evicted was, and bring it forward to your latest work, Poverty by America, and the change you think you can, we all can potentially see, starting with this idea of being poverty abolitionists. I like that concept. But you know, you see what I'm trying to see, how mm-hmm. how you started the conversation in 16 around the poverty and profit motives that exist in the eviction, in home ownership, eviction, and all of that, to what we see today.
Yeah. Evicted was a work of bearing witness. So I moved into Milwaukee, mobile home park. I moved into a rooming house in the inner city and spent time with families getting evicted. Went everywhere with those families and saw a level of poverty that I had never seen before. You know, I met grandmas living without heat in Milwaukee. I saw kids evicted like daily. You know, I remember seeing this eviction of a home that just kids were living in. You know, the mom had died and the kids had just gone on living, and sheriff threw their stuff on the curb. Someone called social service. The landlord drilled a new lock and we were off to the next eviction. And I think that really provoked in me this question of why? Why? You know, why so much hardship in this land of dollars? And I think that to answer that question, you got to write a different kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to expand the aperture. And so there's this line by the novelist Tommy Orange where he writes, it's like these kids are jumping out of the windows of burning buildings, falling to their deaths, and we think that the problem is that they're jumping.
Mm.
And when I read that, I was like, man, that sounds like the poverty debate.
Yeah.
So this book is about the fire. You know, it's about who lit it and who's warming their hands by it.
What don't people get about poverty?
That we have to, that it can end, that it can end, that we don't have to live with it. You know, that we can, like, that the ideal poverty rate is zero. And I think that for some of us, that sounds Pollyannish, that sounds pie in the sky.
It does. But why? Yeah. Why? I mean, stop and think about what we're saying here, that the idea that I'm looking at, I drive through a neighborhood, oh, hell, or even in my own neighborhood, because two blocks around away, you know, there's some folks who are having some struggles, right? So everyone kind of thinks it's somewhere else when really it's right next to you. And ironically, Matt, even some people who are themselves right at that line or just over that line don't see themselves that way. What is it, this whole American dream landscape that we've sort of created, this illusion that, you know, everybody can have the American story, that, you know, the rags to riches phenomenon. But we're talking about generational poverty here. I mean, before we even get into race and racism, we're just talking about poor people. You know, what is it that we don't see about others? Is it that we don't see ourselves in them?
I think we do. And I think that's why we often grab hold of these myths so much, these myths that I can work my way out of it. I can be safe. Like, I'm not going to, they had a failing. I will not have that failing. And
right,
I think
right.
that we don't believe that, but it's comforting, right? Because in the land of the free, we could ascend to very high places, but we could also fall to very great depths. And I think that's terrifying, especially those of us who are parents. It's terrifying for our kids, which is why we just try to dump as much, you know, into them as possible. And so I think, though, something's shifting in the country. I think something's changing. And so most Democrats and most Republicans now feel that poverty is caused by unfair circumstances, you know, not a moral failing. It's different. Most Democrats and most Republicans now believe that the federal minimum wage should be higher, that the rich aren't paying their taxes. And so I feel like the old is dying, but the new hasn't been fully reborn yet. I feel like the country is striving and yearning for a different language of all this inequality.
Yeah, I'd I don't know, man. If I'm with you on that one, I don't know. I don't know if I'm fully there. There is that aspirational aspect of this conversation that I really gravitate towards and want to put a hook in. But then I look at the human condition and all the things that kind of feed off of that condition that don't improve it, but make it worse. And so the us versus them story seems to be the new American narrative,
mm-hmm.
where there are more people inclined to see other than see themselves reflected. And it's not just the there, but for the grace of God go I, but the fact that I have family members, I have friends, I have people I know in this situation. And I really kind of wall them off. I kind of wall them off. And, you know, my social commitment, with the air quotes around social commitment, is, oh, I wrote a check, or I gave a guy who's standing out in front of McDonald's, you know, some pocket change, or even took him inside and got him a Happy Meal, you know. And I can tell you from the work that we're doing, for example, at Catholic Charities, it is about the whole person. It has to be about the whole person, because it's not just the fact that they need a hamburger at the moment, but they need a dentist, they need a shelter, they need, you know, an education. There are all these other pieces that feed the poverty story.
Mm-hmm.
And my question, I guess, is, or concern, is why I'm not, it's like, yay, what you just said, is those other elements aren't necessary. I mean, you're trying to draw our attention to it, because that's part of being an abolitionist. You've got to see, you know, going back and looking at the abolitionist movement in the 1860s, 50s and 60s, it wasn't just about ending slavery. It's like, okay, once you do that, then what?
Right.
You know, 40 acres and a mule, right. Civil, you know, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, voting rights, all these other pieces that were part and parcel of the slave culture. The same is true here in poverty. What are those? How are those other pieces, in your view, getting addressed as well?
Right. I think that one of the things we can ask ourselves is, you know, why do we give? Why do we do that Happy Meal, right? Why do we drop change in someone's cup? And I think that part of the answer is because we feel complicit, you know? And I think that what I'm striving for isn't just the end of poverty. It's a better country. Like, right. I ran across this quote, my wife sent me this today. It's by a book called The Wisdom of the Sands.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes like this: if you want to build a ship, don't gather people together to collect wood, and don't assign task and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. And I feel like a country that ends poverty is a safer country. It's a happier country. It's a freer country. It's you and me going out to eat and knowing that everyone in that restaurant is taken care of. It's the parents knowing that whatever their kid's lot in life, they're going to be protected from this degrading, you know, indignified poverty that we tolerate. So I think that right now the only game in town is try to get as high on the ladder as you can.
Right, right.
But I think that the country wants a different game. And I think the country is longing for something different, including those of us that are very privileged. And the end of poverty, of course, would mean a whole different existence for those who are below the line.
Well, an end to poverty threatens the system, is what I would argue.
But it doesn't have to.
Well, okay. So then that's the corner we got to turn.
Yeah.
Because you got to tell a whole lot of folks out there that, giving that brother and that sister over there an opportunity to actually play the game and engage and realize the American dream that everyone promises is available to them will require something that they have to, they don't want to give up. And that's a little bit of power, a little bit of economy. And it's not a zero sum narrative. That's the problem. A lot of people see this as zero sum. If Matt is better, I'm worse, right? I'm worse off if that happens. And my argument has always been, no, if Matt is better, good for Matt, but I'm hoping that Matt also recognizes that he can contribute to expanding that opportunity as well. It's not just what the government can do. And this is what you write about in terms of when you said that if the top 1% of income earners just paid the taxes they owed, right? Just pay what you owe, baby. This is what you made. This is the tax. Pay it. The country would raise an additional $175 billion. So it's not just what these government programs can do, but it's also what we can do.
Right.
Which is what I love about your wife's sharing of that quote, mm-hmm. because it's something I remember telling Jack Kemp, who always used to talk a great deal about a rising tide lifting all boats, right? And one of the last events I did with Jack of great memory was at the end of that evening. It was at someone's home in the Capital Region, and we were walking out the door and we were talking. And I just said to him, I said, you know, I've listened to you and I've been an acolyte of a lot of what you said. But I said, one of the things that I've come to realize after I leave these conversations is that you're absolutely right. A rising tide lifts all boats, but you got to have a boat first, right? So when that tide of opportunity and prosperity and good times comes, you can rise with it and not be drowned because of it.
Yeah.
And that's where I take the poverty conversation is, how do we as citizens and as institutions make sure that everyone has a boat?
And we're all better off when everyone has a boat.
And now we're all better off when everyone, because I'm not judging you. You got a dinghy, baby. You got a boat, right? I'm not going to judge the size of your boat. The thing is, you're in play. You're in the game, right?
That's right. And I think the reason why I want to be pragmatic about what we could accomplish is, you know, is I guess what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say, like, we both agree that the inclusion of the poor into the union is a benefit to the union itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I think there's a way to do that that's completely tangibly within our grasp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it means making deeper investments in ending poverty, investments paid for by fair and sensible tax enforcement. It means those of us that are in the top 20% taking less from the government than we mm-hmm. do. And that's not redistribution. That's a rebalancing of the safety net. You know, that's making investments to the families that need it the most, not the families that need it the least. And it's finally turning away from segregation and opening up our communities to broad prosperity. On one hand, those are radical changes, right?
Right, right.
But on the other hand, that doesn't mean we have to have a completely different society or usher in a socialist revolution or everything turns upside down. The end of poverty also doesn't fix everything, right? Yeah. I mean, there's still a lot of inequality in a land without poverty. There's still racism and misogyny in a land without poverty. But a land without poverty is just a better place to live, I think, for all of us.
I agree with all of that. And I think for me, you know, as somewhat of a political tactician, I kind of look at it and go, okay, how do we accomplish this given some of the realities that we know? And I think my biggest takeaway now, and I know I'm going to let you get onto your next thing and wrap up the conversation with this final thought from you, at least from what I'm taking away from our conversation and what you've written in Poverty by America, is we have the ability within ourselves to begin to change the nature of this conversation. It really begins with how we reimagine poverty, not as something, oh, those poor people, but as something in which we all have a stake in the outcome.
Right.
I mean, so how is that you would sum up, and what's your takeaway you want folks who are reading this book? And I highly recommend folks, please pick up a copy of Poverty by America. It's out now. But what's your takeaway you want people to have when they, you know, get beyond the statistics and the math and the numbers and all that, the human piece? Because that's what I got from it, was that's why I sort of latched on to this abolitionist thought, because it's such an important strategy in how we begin to talk about this thing.
Yeah, I think that we have to start taking responsibility for this in our own lives. And I'm very wary of any absolving theories of poverty.
Right.
You know, we can't put it on Congress. We can't put it on the richer guy. We can't put it on the shoulders of the poor. My God. I think we need to start taking some ownership over it and asking ourselves, like, what is our political party, our elected representatives? What are our churches and our mosques and our synagogues? What are our schools doing to divest from poverty? And we can join movements. I mean, there's all sorts of incredible movements going on that are fighting poverty right now. So one thing that I've done is create a website called endpovertyusa.org, endpovertyusa.org. And listeners can go there and just look at groups that are fighting this fight on the ground right now and get involved, not only because it's the right thing to do, but also it's just fun and meaningful.
Right. Right.
And you know, if you're longing for community and warmth and big-heartedness, I highly recommend joining an anti-poverty movement.
Well, I appreciate your raising this conversation in such a way that grabs not just the attention, but the imagination of how we can begin to deal with this subject and recognize the human being behind the statistics, the families behind the dark stories, and recognize that we can all become poverty abolitionists in our own way to begin to push ourselves and our communities and our country in a direction that a generation from now, we're not talking about the number of kids in poverty, we're proud of the number who aren't. And I think that's a great effort. Matthew Desmond, really appreciate you taking time, man, to bring our attention to your latest work, Poverty by America, is out now. His earlier work, which really began to change the way we talk about this and think about it, Evicted, Poverty, and Profit in the American City. Pick up a copy of both. They're compendiums on the subject, I would say. And really kind of begin to reimagine and appreciate what we can do to help our neighbor and our families that are stricken by poverty. Appreciate you, brother, very much.
Thank you, Michael. Just really enjoyed this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Well, folks, that sort of wraps us for this week. I love it when you take a moment with us and get to share in the conversation with very, very smart, capable people out there doing some wonderful stuff to help all of us improve our quality of lives in communities like Matthew. Again, check out his work, Poverty by America. Matthew, that website again for the other program where they can just go and get some information.
EndPovertyUSA.org.
EndPovertyUSA.org. Check it out as well. Until next time, folks, you know, take care of yourselves out there. Spring is here. You're beginning to see the flowers kind of, although the temperature dropped to freezing last night. So I got to have a conversation with Mother Nature. But in the meantime, let's get ready for spring. And until next time, be safe and be well. Don't forget to do the downloads. We love it when you do it. Follow Matt on Twitter @just_shelter. And follow me on Twitter @MichaelSteele. and the podcast at Steel_podcast. Until next time, take care.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.